don't have enough members here to say this yet, probably. We better start. Senator Vickerman, welcome to the committee. Senate File 76.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present the Dairy Investment Tax Credit measure. And back again, we were before this committee last year, and we all know the tax bills kind of went different directions, so nothing became of it. So I'm back again this year and to hope that we can include it in our tax bill. I know I've had support in the years before, and I hope this year that we can finally put this tax credit in place. Now, what we're trying to do, Mr. Chairman, the committee, is provide some incentive for regeneration of our dairy industry. Dairy industry is Minnesota's fourth largest industry, bigger in terms of jobs in the state than Target, 3M, and Northwest Airlines all combined. All of those jobs are tied to supply of milk provided by our dairy farms. We need to encourage reinvestment in these operations so we face losing not just the on-farm dairy producers' jobs, but jobs at our processing and bottling plants in cities and towns across the state. Now, Mr. Chair, I have with me some organizations that work for hardness issue, and it would be all right with you, Mr. Chair, essence of time, they could start and testify. Would that be you?
Senator Vickerman, maybe we should try to get all of them up to the table just in the interest of time, and the testimony might go a little faster then, but you can start with whoever you like, but others that are going to testify on the bill, if you could kind of get a little closer to the table.
Chair, then I'm going to start out with Mr. Borboom from the Assistant Commissioner of Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Explain a little bit.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Jim Borboom, Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I have a few brief remarks just regarding the economic impact of the dairy industry to the state of Minnesota. And actually, the impact of the dairy enterprise begins on the farm when farmers purchase such items as feed, farm supplies, fuel, and veterinary care. And every year, dairy farmers make investments in breeding livestock, machinery and equipment, or building improvements in order to operate or expand their dairy operation. I looked at the farm business management records for 2005, and those records show that the average dairy farmer spends $536,000 a year. About $106,000 of that is for feed, and $102,000 is for capital improvements. These kind of expenditures that farmers make annually pump more than $1.2 billion into our state economy. And with other agriculture sectors, the dairy sector provides a lot of economic impact through the multiplier effect, through which one business creates opportunities for another business. Minnesota is home to several cooperatives and private companies that lead the nation in dairy food processing. They include Land O'Lakes, Associated Milk Producers, Bondgaard's Creamery, First District, Kraft, Kemp's, and Davisco Foods, to name a few. The most recent ag marketing services from our agency show that the total impact of the dairy production and processing industry in Minnesota exceeds $10 billion. And that same report showed that the total employment impact of the dairy industry is at 76,000 jobs. Through this multiplier effect, it is estimated that one dairy cow generates about $15,000 in economic activity. So, Mr. Chairman and members, the effect of the dairy industry to our local economies is significant, and this bill, certainly happy to support that. Thank you.
Chair, my another witness, Mr. Bruce Stone, who's taking the place of Bob Lefbury. Mr. Stone representing the Minnesota Milk Producers Association.
I'm Bruce Stone. I'm from Hinning, Minnesota. I'm a dairy producer and the director of Minnesota Milk Producers. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity today to ask for your support of Senate File 76, the Dairy Investment Tax Credit. We live on a family dairy farm and produce milk with my wife, Arlene, son, Ryan, his wife, Sarah, and six full-time employees. We milk 350 cows and farm 500 acres, raising corn and alfalfa. We raise our heifer calves to about 200 pounds, where they go back to a neighboring farm to raise until they return to the dairy. The dairy tax investment credit is essential for all dairy producers. Here's an example of what producers will invest as a result. My 25-year-old neighbor, dairy producer, currently milking 70 cows, would like to build a new freestall barn so he could grow. the barn would cost approximately $1,500 per cow. With all the input costs going up, it's for the producer, production has to grow to meet a family living expenses. Some examples of the equipment cost: a milking parlor is about $4,000 per stall. A manure transfer pump is approximately $9,000. A TMR mixer, a pole type to mix the feed, is $30,000. A crowd gate for the holding area is $12,000. The dairy investment tax credit is good for rural communities. The on-farm reinvestment will cause a ripple effect through our small communities. In my area, Professional Dairy Services of Wadena has dairy farm equipment and supplies. Mid-Central Equipment of Henning has livestock equipment. Prairie Implement of Parker's Prairie has farm equipment. And Pro-Ag Co-op has feed and supplies. All these businesses need dairy producers to flourish. Dairy investment tax credit is good for Minnesota. Small communities with dairies nearby will flourish. Helping to keep rural Minnesota an alternative attractive travel destination, metro areas benefit as a result of increased processing companies such as Dean's Foods, Kemp's, Land O'Lakes, which results in more jobs. Dairy investment tax credit is good for our other environment. Modern dairy production systems are environmental stewardship systems. When facilities are modern, a dairy investment tax credit will allow producers to improve their environment stewardship while modernizing their dairies. Mr. Chair, I ask that you pass the dairy investment tax credit for the sake of dairy producers, the tens of thousands of jobs and people employed in the dairy industry, for rural communities, the state, and the environment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If there's any questions, I'd have to answer.
Mr. Chair, I have two more people, but I think in essence of time, I will just state their views. Tom Peterson represents Minnesota's Farmers Union. He's all for the bill, and so is Chris Raddatz, the Minnesota Farm Bureau. So I will just announce that they're fully in support of the bill. Questions that maybe members would ask, Mr. Borboom can help me follow through them, if that would be all right, rather than, because I know you're got a busy schedule.
Senator Vickram, I'm interested in one thing. I see the credit can be carried forward up to 15 years. So, I mean, potentially a dairy farmer could have virtually no tax liability for an awful long period of time. You think maybe that 15 years stretches it out a little bit far?
Mr. Chairman, part of the bill, I believe, has a six-year window where the dairy producer is eligible to utilize the credit, and then, as you mentioned, there's a 15-year carry forward. I think the 15-year carry forward is maybe consistent with some other provisions in tax law. I know that farmers typically have about a $8,000 to $20,000 tax liability, if I've looked at some of the records, so that is not a large tax liability, and they probably would need that 15 years in order to utilize the credit.
Mr. Chair, I want to have it on record that the Minnesota Associative Cooperatives also support the bill. Rather than have them talk, I'll just put that on.
Very good. Any question from members on Senate File 76? If not, the chair will lay over Senate File 76 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Senator Vickerman, Senate File 160.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Oh, geez. That one gets expensive.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate File 160 would allow Minnesota soldiers and veterans to subtract 100% of their pay for military service and military pensions when preparing their state income tax. The bill would provide for an income tax exclusion phased in over a four-year period. Passing this bill, Mr. Chair, members, is the right thing, I think, to do to honor the sacrifices made by our Minnesota military while in service to our country. It also would put Minnesota right in step with the majority of states that provide income tax relief for military and veterans. Minnesota is only one of seven states that does not provide this tax benefit to its veterans. Passing this bill isn't just the right thing to do to honor us, but it's a smart thing to do. From an economic viewpoint, military retirees in Minnesota receive over $20 million a month in military pension income and spend their money on goods and services. Attracting military retirees to our states are good for our economy. Passing this bill isn't just a smart thing to do. As I said before, it pays off in business development and high-paying jobs. Military retirees are younger than other retirees and have a high level of technical skills. Many military retirees are using their technology skills to start up businesses that provide high-paying jobs. Minnesota businesses are recruiting military retirees to work for them because they have the skills and the discipline they're looking for to make a positive contribution to their company. Minnesota should foster this business and job creation. In closing, Mr. Chair, I simply would like to reiterate that passing Senate File 166 is the right thing to do to honor our military and veterans. It's a smart thing to do to strengthen our economy, and it pays off in business development and high-paying jobs. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have some witnesses that I want you to hear from, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to start the first one out, and it's going to be introduced Rick Uticus. Uticus. Rick Uticus. I hope I didn't hurt your name too much.
Close.
He's the Vice President of Lockheed Martin, and he would give us a view of how he thinks. Welcome, Mr. Mitchell.
Thank you. And I must say I'm delighted to be here, and I thank all of you for paying attention to this very important topic. And I'm privileged to be able to exercise not only my civic but my business responsibility in this very critical area. I'm the general manager of the Lockheed Martin business, which we have based here in Eagan, Minnesota. And I would really like to encourage you to understand why it's important to draw veterans and keep veterans in the state. And I also have the ability to speak from experience. I served in the military, active and reserves, and retired as a Navy captain after more than 26 years of active and reserve duty. I'm currently building a home in Minnesota, and I have become very familiar with this state's tax statistics, which I do not find competitive across the nation, having lived in over five different states. I would like to share my personal viewpoint of why it's important that we hire veterans and support those who are also in the military reserve. Across Lockheed Martin Corporation, which is over 140,000 employees, we have over 30,000 veterans, many of whom are active reservists or military retirees. As a corporation, we have a commitment to serve our country and commitment to national security initiatives, and in many cases, we are providing things which are in direct support of the U.S. military or the U.S. government. That is our major customer. In fact, I could say that the citizens of the country are a major customer, and we're very proud to say that we never forget who we're working for. In Minnesota, I've also seen that we have over 3,000 men and women reservists standing ready to serve, many who deploy and stand side by side with their active counterparts. So how can we say in one breath that we support the troops and believe that they're doing an amazing job, and in the next not provide some motivation to have them stay or be attracted to our state? The long-term benefits that veterans can bring to Minnesota business should far outweigh any question of some near-term cost adjustment to the tax plan. The folks have chosen to stand up and support our country, and I think it's time for us to show them how supportive and appreciative we are of the personal sacrifice and in many cases, the family sacrifice that they made by frequent relocation, deployment, and in many, many cases, never having the opportunity to own their own home, and those who do often own their own home for only a few years, so they're just paying the interest and not gaining the equity. Minnesota business will also benefit from such a plan. because the skills, level of professionalism, experience, and leadership that veterans bring to our business and community cannot be measured purely in a tax bill. In Lockheed Martin, in Minnesota, we have over 2,000 employees in the state. Our business depends on having a business where we have highly qualified people who understand the customer's needs. We have a specific program in our corporation to actively recruit veterans and, in many cases, to target junior military officers who are separating after their initial tour of duty. As a Naval Academy graduate who went on to get my master's degree, I can tell you that I'm very proud of the statistics of veterans in the workplace today. Over 90% of military retirees hold a bachelor's degree, and over 50% of them hold a master's degree. This is precisely the kind of workforce that we need to recruit and retain, not only in our business, but in our state. I would call to your attention a recent USA Today article, February 16th, more employers recruit the military work ethic. And anybody who reads about the war for talent in the U.S. industry, whether it's aerospace and defense, technology, or otherwise, should read this article, probably knows many of the things that are in it already, but I would commend it to your attention. So it is a tough market, and it's a thin market for qualified workers. All businesses are fighting a war for talent, and we need to maintain and motivate that workforce. Also in Minnesota, Lockheed Martin Corporation depends on over 940 small businesses in the state, many of whom rely on the same workforce that we're talking about today. Now, the federal government places a premium on veteran-owned small businesses, so why should we not add an incentive for those veteran-owned small businesses to choose Minnesota as their state for operation and growth? I understand your job as representatives of the citizens is to protect all of our interests as well as the state budget. And as a business leader, I'm here to share with you that if we draw veterans into our state and maintain those who have served us with commitment and personal sacrifice, our businesses and our business climate will benefit and provide enhancements well beyond the dollar values of the budget concerns on the table today. Recently at our facility in Eagan, Minnesota, we had a special guest speaker, Mr. Shelby Westbrook, who will soon receive the Congressional Gold Medal and was an original Tuskegee Airman who served this country with valor during World War II. And he had the distinction of being attached to the first all-black unit formed by the Army Air Corps. I was struck by one of the comments that our employees asked him, whether it was hard for him to return to the environment which was plagued with inequality in the 1940s. And his reply was a resounding positive response that he and many of his fellow comrades went on to great positions of responsibility, both in industry and government, or continuing on in military service. A third stayed in the military, many became doctors, lawyers, and teachers, and Mr. Westbrook himself obtained a bachelor's degree and eventually became an electrical engineer. He added with emphasis at the end of his speech that the GI Bill was one of the most important and life-changing things that came out of his time serving in the military. Many veterans were able to improve their lives by experiencing things they never thought they would have a chance to do. And he said that through these kind of benefits, his life and his family future improved. I could also tell you stories of personal friends. I'll skip all the details, but I know people who live in New York where they do not pay taxes on their military retirement, and they made conscious decisions for that relocation based on that. And I also know a family who recently relocated here whose son is at the U.S. Air Force Academy, and they downsized their home because of the cost of living here and because now moving from Pennsylvania, his tax burden went up significantly, not just due to the total tax burden of the state, but because his military pension, which had not been taxed in Pennsylvania, is now taxed in Minnesota. So, what can we do about this? I believe we can change our future. We can change not only the future of the veterans, we can change the business future of Minnesota. And I believe that's what I hear in the national news. And in fact, I was very proud to hear on CNN what I thought was already a de facto commitment to veterans, and I'm proud to be here testifying that I hope that that commitment, which sounded like it was real on the national news, becomes, in fact, a bill in this great state. More importantly, we can also make the future of those who have faithfully served our military and the country, those who put their lives on hold, who sacrificed their lives, and in some cases, families who don't have a member today because of that. And they stood in the face of adversity and protected us. So I believe it is in your hands today. I understand the reason we're having a hearing is because we need to have everything considered carefully. But I heard in the opening remarks, and I absolutely believe this is the right thing to do. It's the right time for it. It will make this state more competitive and put the state in a leadership role in one of the key areas for our nation and our business. I thank you very much for the time to put forward these remarks today, and I welcome any questions you might have.
Mr. Eutychus.
Yes.
We're looking at a fiscal, we call it a fiscal note on this, that show how much it will cost the state to, I mean, to provide this exemption. And I'm just wondering, it's broken out in two ways. Military pensions would cost the state in this upcoming biennium about $9.1 million. Exempting military pay for people currently serving would cost about 3.6. So the total is about 12.7 million. If we can't find the $12.7 million to do everything, what would be your observation about what would be more important? Exempting from income tax the military pay of people currently serving, or people that are currently in Minnesota drawing military pensions? Because those are the decisions we have to make here. We can't do everything, so we have to prioritize things.
I'll give you a personal opinion not based on any data. But my personal opinion would be that the pension exemption would have a more significant impact because, in my assessment, we are looking at the ability to retain people here for the long term, not necessarily deal with people who are early to mid-career. And so if you talk about a long-term benefit, the pension is certainly the more impactful point and reaches a wider segment because many folks who are currently serving in a guard, reserve, or active capacity will also see the pension at the end. So if I had to pick one, personally, I'd pick the pension. But I would encourage you to step up to a leadership role and pick both.
Mr. Eutychus, the leadership role is if we exempt somebody's income from taxes, we have to raise taxes on somebody else. I mean, I just want people to understand this money isn't free. We actually have to raise income taxes on somebody else. And this may be, I mean, you make a very strong argument we should do this. But we all just need to understand that somebody has to pay for it. That's all.
And I make the comment based on the expectation that this will not just be a retroactive benefit to those people who have already chosen this state for their residence. I would view this as an investment by the state to make the state more competitive in the global and national jobs market and in the business market where veterans who choose to start a business would consider starting that business in Minnesota instead of leaving it off the screen due to tax purposes. So I would not, if you thought this was population and job neutral, I would not be here today. If I thought this were population and job neutral, I would not be here today. Wouldn't mean anything.
Senator Moy.
You know, Mr. Chair, it's no secret that I'm a big supporter of our veterans, and I've made that very public. And I just want to preface that when I ask this question is that I don't know very much about military pensions or military pay, but I have an awful lot of people in my Senate district who are former veterans who are fighting to get meals from Meals on Wheels and who are just trying to pay their medical expenses while skimping on their food stamps and really, trying to make ends meet. And I guess I just want to know if this bill is going to somehow benefit some of those of my constituents who are veterans but who really are low income or are really just having a really hard time right now.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a response to Senator Moore. Just a comment that I've been here for about 5 years, and I keep hearing the same argument that if we do the right thing with the tax policy on this bill, somebody else is going to have to pay for it, and we're going to have to raise taxes somewhere else. And with all due respect, 5 years later, I guess I haven't had enough of the Kool-Aid, but I still think that we should just do the right thing with our tax policy, and if we have a little less money, then maybe we spend a little less money. But it seems to me these folks make the perfect argument for that leadership position, which is we should not be taxing military pensions or military pay. And they're asking us to get this right. And I think we should get it right. Let's make sure that we don't tax their pensions, make sure we don't tax their pay. They've provided great service with honor and dignity to our country, and it's time for us in this committee to get over the argument that if we're going to raise or not tax them, we have to raise taxes elsewhere. I think we should be looking at this whole system a little bit differently and say, what should our tax policy do for our residents? And in this case, it should not put an extreme burden on our servicemen.
Senator Ortman, the position of this tax chair is going to be that if we're gonna collect the same amount of money in income tax in the next biennium as we did in this one. I hope we don't have to collect more. It'll depend on how much the finance committees want to spend. But we can't just keep cutting revenue and expect to continue to provide money for schools and make sure we keep nursing homes open and build a transportation system. So all I'm saying is I think our income tax system needs to be revenue neutral. And this is a very good idea. But I just want the committee to know how I feel is that if we're going to cut somebody, then we need to raise a little money in the income tax system so that at the end of the day, our finance committees have at least the same amount of money they do today to provide for the other things we need in the state budget. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad we're having this discussion because, quite honestly, experts in finance houses have talked to me, and they're beginning to see something that's rather universal. People on retirement incomes are beginning to move away from Minnesota, and we know that. And it's not just the military, but it's other people in retired populations. And they're moving to states that are a little easier on pension incomes, fixed pension incomes. The problem that I see is, yes, we could see that go, but at the same time, those people contribute to Minnesota by buying things and purchasing things that are going to trigger sales tax. They invest here. I'd like to keep those people in Minnesota as long as possible, because the other tendency that we're beginning to see is when they get into their late 70s and early 80s, they start moving back to Minnesota because of our generous health care benefits that we offer where other states don't. So we as a state are getting kind of a double whammy. We lose income potential by retirees moving out of the state. They take away their buying power. They are not contributing to our sales tax. Our senior citizens are still investing. They're still viable as an economic contributing unit to wherever they move to. I might dare say that the tax policies that are oftentimes created right here in this room are beginning to drive our seniors away from Minnesota. And that means that there's going to be an added increase in funding that is going to be required from everyone else that remains here. Now, as we begin to look at taking money away from or taxing one group in order to lower taxes on another, we're just looking on one side of the ledger sheet with that statement. I can't imagine out of a $34 billion budget that we can't find $12 million out of our state budget where everyone in every little spending operation in the state of Minnesota could throw in a couple bucks in order to recognize the work that Senator Vickerman's group that he represents could gain and benefit from. I didn't serve in the service when I was younger. The Vietnam War was just recently over when I graduated from high school. And yet at the same time, relatives, cousins, uncles all contributed to that effort during the time when I was a younger man. But that doesn't change the appreciation that I have and many of us have for our military. I can't imagine that we can't find $12 million to handle this problem and recognize the sacrifice that these men and women conducted. We always look at the tax side of the ledger, but we never quite try to figure out the spending side of our ledger. It's like it's in a different universe. When we have a conversation about this type of thing, we've got to bring both sides of that ledger page in. I would imagine that there's room in our $34 billion budget that we can find room for this.
Senator Limerick, you made the comment that oftentimes retirees move back to Minnesota, maybe when their health fails. And I think there's some data that will prove that out. But I think you might have misspoke a little bit when you said because of our generous health care. I think it's probably more our quality health care system that we have here in Minnesota, and we all should be proud of that. And all of our retirees, when their health gets more frail, certainly depend on that. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry I don't have my bill here today, but I have a bill for federal retirees, a small exemption on their taxes. They make the same argument that if they could stay in the state they love and add revenue, it offsets the fiscal note that will come along with the bill. But it's just a small incentive to keep them in the state.
Senator Johnson, how much does your bill cost?
I don't know yet, Mr. Chairman. It's less than it was in the past. It was $40,000 to match up to their federal exemption, and it's down to $10,000. So I'm not sure what the fiscal note will be. But their argument is true. They would like to stay here and add revenue.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson, my ex-father-in-law, who recently passed away, spent 42 years at 3M. And when he retired, he stayed in Minnesota. And he paid taxes to the state that provided for a job, that provided for the needs of his family. And not everybody's gonna fly away. I agree that the flight problem is probably an issue, but anybody with pension income, I think, can probably make that argument. We're more likely to stay if we don't have to pay any taxes in your state. Senator Langston.
Mr. Chair, this is my 33rd year in the legislature. Occasionally, I'm envious of people in the minority, but I've never been there. But the minority can always out-promise the majority without coming up with the money to pay for it. I've heard ever since I've been in the legislature, this big flight of people from Minnesota. Minnesota has the fastest population growth in the Midwest by quite a ways. Even our sister state of Wisconsin, we have a considerably higher population growth. Now, my parents spent a fair amount of time in Arizona. It wasn't because of the taxes. They paid Minnesota taxes. But they thought January was better in Arizona than it was in Minnesota. And that's why they went. And I don't know. I think we kind of oversell this idea about this big flight that's going on. All you have to do is read the statistics to see that Minnesota is way ahead of the Midwest, not only in population growth, but also in income growth.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Langseth, I would argue that the growth is in people raising families, trying to come here for our good education systems and just some really clean living.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope that we will get right to the premise that we've had in this committee that we're trying to do something that's revenue neutral. We don't do anything revenue neutral at the Capitol. Our revenues go up every single year. Even in our worst year, with a $4.5 billion deficit, our revenues were going up. Minnesotans were paying more taxes. And so we should just get over the idea that what we're doing here is revenue neutral and we're balancing our income with our spending. What we really need is, and I know it's going to take a lot, it's going to take some guts and some courage in the Minnesota State Senate to say, get rid of the premise, start over, and let's make sure our tax policy makes some sense. And I really am hopeful that with the new chairman being here, we can get over that terrible argument which says that we have to weigh everything against each other and that we have to pay for new programs at someone else's expense. We should do the right thing, Mr. Chair.
Sir.
And, Mr. Chair, with all due respect to Senator Langseth, there are some very responsible members of this minority that have some very good ideas, and you should just not dismiss them for the idea that we are not responsible. We're very responsible. We sit here every day with good ideas.
Senator Ortman, it's not this committee's job to spend money. That's in the division of the Finance Committee. And they're going to make those decisions about what the next state budget looks like. And we're going to have an obligation to raise the money. This is where the hard votes are going to be taken. But when we also decide we want to spend money, in addition to the Finance Committee, we just make it that much more difficult to make sure that we can continue to provide for the things that our citizens want in our communities.
Mr. Chair, if I could respond. I think you've missed my point. This is not spending money. I don't want to be on Senator Cohen's Finance Committee. I've never signed up for it. I'm saying let's raise less, and let's not raise money on the backs of our military folks. They can't afford it. We shouldn't be asking them to pay it, and we should get it right. And it's not spending, it's raising less. And maybe Senator Cohen's committee can decide to spend less, or else we can raise money elsewhere. But this is the right thing to do this time.
Senator Ortman, you know how, you've been here long enough to know how money's counted. And there's a fiscal note on this bill that says it costs money if we pass it. So that's just, I mean, and to say anything less is just denying the obvious. Senator Arson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to respond a little to what Senator Limmer said, because I heard almost exactly the same argument you made. And I'm sure that a lot of people in the audience agree with the argument that can't we just, I mean, $12 million. I mean, if we can't find that in our 30-plus billion-dollar budget, you know, how is that possible? I heard the same thing last night at one of the schools in my school district. We had a hearing there last night, and I heard a lot of stories about how we had to have, bake sales, and we had to have paper drives, not only reams of paper, but toilet paper drives where parents had to bring in those kinds of supplies. Soap. There wasn't enough soap for some of the for the kids to have soap when they wash their hands. And so, you know, while Senator Ortman had, also responding to your point, too, that it's less money, it's less money that we spend in the total state budget on other things. And so it's a much more difficult balance than just saying it's the right thing to do and we ought to go ahead and do it. We just saw a presentation by the state demographer and the state economist here about a month ago that told us that as we look out into our future, we're going to see significant reductions in our ability to recover dollars from a retiring population. And so I think that we have to be really careful, and I think that a great case has been made for some of the reasons why we might do this. But on the other hand, we have to realize that we're going to have a lot of long-term impacts with the things that we decide today. And there's a great deal of money here that will no longer be there for schools and all the other things that have made Minnesota great.
Senator Vickerman, anybody else would like to testify?
Mr. Chair, I think we're kind of getting more off of what my bill, my bill was going.
Senator Vickerman, I think we're on your bill.
Mr. Chair, if it'd be all right, I have two other people that will add a little different light to it, because I know Mr. Oldis is a very important person, probably come away from the business to be here, and I'm very glad of that. But
I actually changed my schedule because this was the most important thing that anybody asked me to do today. So I'm very proud to be here, and I resound with the comments there. I will leave you with just one more statistic. If you compare the revenue spent by Minnesotans on federal taxes with the revenue returned to Minnesota from the Department of Defense Appropriations Bill, you will find that Minnesota is paying more than getting back on the national average. So I would one more time make the case this is investment, not expense. Thank you very much for the time today.
Mr. Chair, then I have two more witnesses, Ralph Donis and Colonel Nesbitt will come up and add a little bit to it.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Nesbitt. I reside in Hastings, Minnesota. I joined the United States Army Air Corps in those days, not the predecessor of the Air Force, in 1948, and in 1953, I graduated from the United States Military Academy at West Point with 12 other students from the state of Minnesota. Of those 12, us 12, only one returned to the state for retirement. As I continued my military career, I graduated from the United States Defense University, which used to be the Defense War College in Washington, D.C. There were 9 students there from Minnesota. One returned for retirement. Now, I'll let you figure those numbers out. But what I'm talking about here are 20 very important people to the state of Minnesota. It was an investment on the part of Minnesota that got them to those schools. And they became very highly educated. None of them come back, only myself. And that bothered me, and I had to ask the question, why? And so what I'd like to do for you today, and some of it has already been done, and I apologize for any repetition, is give you a profile of who the people are that we're talking about. Who are these military retirees? Well, first of all, they're going to be roughly age 40 to 50, 55 years in age when they retire. And that's because of the nature of the system. And you see, they're going to be forced to retire at that time because the military is a young man's business. I can remember walking up down the hills of Vietnam with an 80-pound rucksack on my back and carrying 2 full canteens of water. And I carried 2 because I didn't want to go down at night to the stream alone to fill my canteens when they ran out. But in addition to that, 40 to 50 years of age, they're not going to be able to just vegetate when they retire. They're going to have to get another job. And so where are they going to get that job? They're going to look in the locale that they retire in. And that's logical. But I'll come back to that. The retiree is going to bring with him funds. These funds are not going to be dedicated funds, as many of them are in the state. They're going to be discretionary funds available to be spent in the state of Minnesota. They're not dedicated. He's going to, by your figures, he's going to bring in $22,000 to $23,000 a year. And when you multiply that out, that comes out to $250 million a year. That's a small industry. And it's an important industry, even to the state of Minnesota, with the few military retirees that they have. And I think you have to take cognizance of this, because when they come back in, they're going to, even though they're asking you, we're asking you now to give up the taxation on military retired pay, they're going to expand the tax bases, as has been pointed out, of property taxes, sales tax, all the other taxes that are paid in the state of Minnesota. In addition to that, when they reach the appropriate age, you see, they have never had the opportunity to build up an equity in their houses, as already been pointed out, because they move every 18 months to 3 years. And in the movement, the real estate costs eat up any equity that they had. As a matter of fact, most of them lose money on the house when they have to buy one. By the same virtue that the other funds that they bring in, they're going to spend not only to buy a house, and sales tax for the property, the other things they use, they're going to have entertainment, and they're going to pay all those other taxes that are not being considered today by the committee. Now, I think that when I went to the National War College, I also attended a course in economic development at George Washington University. And at that course, they told us that money coming into an economic system from outside has a multiplier factor of 7 applied to it. Monies internal to an economic system have a multiplying factor of 3 to 4. So now when we're talking in terms of $250 million a year, you can see the economic impact that this would have upon the state of Minnesota. The retiree, when he gets ready to retire, makes what we call an estimate of the situation. That's a military term. And what he does, he sits down, like any good person would do, any good person that's taking stock of his finances, looks at what he has, what he wants, and where the course, what are the courses of action as far as retiring is concerned. Now, 43 other states give some sort of recognition to benefits for military retired pay. Minnesota stands alone, not alone, with seven others, one of seven. I submit to you that the individual that's out there and getting ready to retire, the biggest issue that he's going to consider is finances. And in considering finances, his biggest issue is retirement, because he does not have the equity that you've built up by living in the state of Minnesota continually in a home or in lakeshore property or in a hobby farm, whatever you're talking about. These things he's put in the past when he went off to serve his country. And as a result, the biggest factor probably in making a decision as to where to retire is how his finances are going to be able to be protected. And the biggest issue in his finance package is retirement, his retirement pay. Now, in addition to that, he'll probably have some investments. He'll probably have an IRA, and he'll probably have a savings account. But those are not what we have under consideration today. When I gave you the profile of a typical military retiree, I wonder how many of you could identify with that. Have you ever heard of them before? Because these are the sons and daughters of many of you, and the sons and daughters are your constituents. And what you're talking about is I heard the comment, you're asking them to stay here, and people who worked here stayed here, and that's right. But you see, the people we're talking about today, the military retiree, you're not asking him to stay here. You're asking him to come back after he's been gone for 20 to 30 years. And you have to give him incentive to do that, because he can go somewhere else and protect his retirement pay. And there's no other incentive to come back here. The biggest drawing card for me, and the only reason I come back to this state, I'll be very frank with you, was my family and the family of my wife. And we have many times sat down around our dinner table and discussed the fact, would we be better off moving to South Dakota? We lived in South Dakota for 3 years. Would we be better off moving across the Mississippi River from Hastings to Prescott? I wonder if the same question is being asked in Red Wing, in Winona, if the same thing is being asked in Moorhead, where you have an active military base across the border, because active military bases are, in addition to the finances, how his finances are treated, the availability of an active military base is important to the retiring veteran, because he has certain benefits connected therewith. Those benefits have been degraded over time, but they're still there. And if nothing else, it's just the comradeship that he has with people sharing a common background. But I heard another comment here today that I want to address, and that's taxes. I realize that the primary source of governmental revenue is taxes. But I think it's important to understand that while that generates the revenue, it's the people that pay the taxes. And without the people, you don't have any taxes. As an example, the income tax is a tax we pay for the right to work. Property tax is the tax we pay for the right to own property. Sales tax, the right that we pay in order to consume. And you can go right down the line. But as I pointed out earlier, if all the funds coming in here from these people are discretionary funds, that's no problem. They're ready to pay those taxes. I'd like to go through a mental gymnastics with you for a moment, if you'll bear with me. According to the state, when a military person retires and returns to the state, he brings with him $23,000 worth of income on the average. When he retires at the age of 40, 50, He's too young to totally retire. He's not going to vegetate. He's going to find other employment. That other employment, if we make that employment at $15 an hour, now with the person that we identified here, you know, having minimum bachelor's degree, doctorate's degree in some cases, but primarily a master's degree and baccalaureate degrees, if he can't find a job at $15 an hour, our economy is in sorry shape. At $15 an hour, working a 40-hour work week, 50 weeks a year, allowing 2 weeks for vacation, he's going to bring in $30,000. He has a wife, and that wife probably is going to go to work, and I shouldn't say wife, and I apologize for that. But the spouse should be able to find employment at $10 an hour. Now you're getting down there quite a ways, but at $10 an hour, the spouse is going to bring in $20,000. So that's additional $50,000 of income that's taxable by the state of Minnesota for giving up $23,000. Now, the more important factor is it's $20,000 plus $30,000 is $50,000, and the $23,000, which is still available for spending, even though it's taxed, that additional $23,000 gives you $73,000 per family of new income circulating in the state of Minnesota to pump up the economy. Now, what I'm telling you is that I would encourage you to look at the glass as being three-quarters full instead of half empty when you consider this bill. Because the state of Minnesota, in the long run, is going to be the beneficiary. And what we're looking at here, as I want to repeat, is the fact that this is a $250 million industry to the state of Minnesota, and it's going to be impacted. I know that your fiscal notes indicate that you have 16,000 people retired in the state of Minnesota from the military. In contacting the Department of Defense, they indicate that the Department of Defense Finance Agency is cutting checks to 14,000 plus a year. Now, that indicates that we've dropped 2,000 somewhere. We could have expanded this base by some reason I'm not familiar with. I understand that the Coast Guard is included now and maybe some other people too. But the point is that we've lost the military retiree. And that big bump, I would suggest, well, it's probably due primarily because of people that are dying from World War II and Korea. But we're not getting the people back in to replace them. That's what I'm telling you. And the people that are out there that could be replacing them are migrating across the border to Wisconsin, where all their income taxes, our military pay is not taxed, North Dakota, where you have the military base, South Dakota, where they have no state taxation, so it's not fair to consider that state probably. But let me tell you again, I'll repeat it. When I stationed in South Dakota, I took out a checking account. I still have that checking account in my pocket because I'm trying to convince my wife on several occasions that maybe we should move to South Dakota where my military retirement isn't taxed. She keeps talking me out of it, so you have her to thank, not me. I've also thought of moving across the river, the Mississippi River, to Prescott, because I have strong ties to Prescott, having grown up being educated in the city of Hastings. But, again, it's just too late for me, probably. It's too late for me to benefit from the bill, let me put it that way. Because my age is working against me these years. I have trouble even remembering things. And with that, I'll just terminate my comments, sir.
Here, I have another witness in.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Ralph Dene, for the record. I'm here today to highlight some of the reasons why this tax exemption for military pensions is an idea that has been long past due in Minnesota. To give you a little bit of my background, I was born in Minnesota, and after graduating from high school, I enlisted in the United States Marine Corps in 1964. I traveled around the world, and when possible, I took my family with me. This is a little hard for me. I was separated from my family many times. I missed the birth of my daughter, their first steps, their first words, their first parties, things that I sacrificed for our country. But like most military retirees, the main reason I returned to Minnesota is because this is where my wife wanted to live. But I'm not here to talk about the hardships or the sacrifices that one must endure to serve our country. I'm here to talk about the future of Minnesota. I have attended meetings with the business leaders who are looking for ways to expand the ability to attract industry to our state. Those same leaders forecast a work shortage in the next 5 years in Minnesota. They have stated that they want and need military retirees so our state can remain competitive with other states and cities across our nation. Military retirees bring a well-educated workforce, with most of us having at least a basic college degree. Military retirees have been educated in leadership, management, and the technical skills. Retirees are needed to keep Minnesota's industries on a continuing or higher level. On the financial side of retirees bringing monies earned outside the state, our current economy in the state of Minnesota receives $250 million a year into our economy that comes with the retirees' checks. We only rank 33rd in the nation for the amount of retirees that live per state. We're way at the bottom of the list. And four or five of those that are behind us on the list are those that are 100% tax, as Minnesota is on the pensions. Retirees bring their own medical coverage to our state. What better employee would you like to bring into your business than someone that already has medical coverage? I mean, business leaders say, hey, I want that person because I don't have to worry about the medical costs. We bring that with us. Since the last report in the DOD actuary from 2005, Minnesota has decreased by 1,820 retirees. Where I got the 1,820 decrease was from the Defense Finance and Accounting System, the people that send us our paychecks. That is the amount of paychecks that they have indicated to me in September of last year that they are sending into the state of Minnesota. So finally, I ask again that you look to Minnesota's future and think about our need for qualified workers to keep the state's economy growing by bringing workers into the state that can achieve that goal. I would like to point out the handout that I sent around to everybody. This basically talks about many of the points that I brought out in my discussion so far, but I'd like you to go to page 2 of that handout. In the remarks column, it shows where I got this data from, and it shows that Minnesota is way down there towards the bottom, being 33rd in the nation at 0.83%. If you use last year's totals in the United States for military retirees and use the current check sent to Minnesota numbers, that number has now dropped down to 0.74, which means we are going to have less and less money coming into our budgets in the state. The next page, if you'd turn to that one, please, it shows again the last 5 years tracking Minnesota's growth, if you would call it that. We have only increased 500 or 600 retirees in 5 years into the state of Minnesota, according to the actuary. And again, I point out the 14,429 as stated by DFAS, the people that sent us our paychecks. Just below that is an even bigger important factor that I'd like you to look at. If you notice there, comparing Minnesota with Wisconsin. Wisconsin enacted a tax exemption for their military retirees several years ago. If you look at the bottom figure down there, $1.67 million more per month come into the state of Wisconsin in military retirement checks. And if you multiply that by 12, guess what? That's over $19 million more per year that the state of Wisconsin is bringing into their budget because they are tax exemption. I have asked the research departments to try and give me a figure of how much money $250 million would generate in taxes, sales taxes, taxes on buying a home, buying a boat, buying an ATV, all those things that military retirees did not have the option to buy while we were moving all over the world. Personally, I moved 30 times in 28 years with my family. As the gentleman earlier stated, I had no equity in anything when I retired. The only thing I truly owned was the furniture that was packed in a moving van and shipped to Minnesota when I retired. The very last two pages of the item that I handed out was the email that I got from DFAS stating those figures that I have cited today. I would thank you for your time. I would ask you to take a good hard look, because in my eyes, currently we bring $250 million into the state. We should be at about 3% of the retirees in the United States should be residing in Minnesota. That would double or triple the amount of money coming into the state. So we're talking about $500 million or more coming to our state. It's not about giving up money. It's about bringing more money and qualified workers into the state. I thank you, and if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them for you.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Donnie?
Yes, sir.
Very interesting, and I think you're right. We need to, you know, make sure that we are competitive with our surrounding states. I think it's important that we, be a state that's welcoming and hopefully people want to move to. When I look at some of the other surrounding states, North and South Dakota, and the colonel talked about them not having an income tax, they're significantly less than Minnesota. And, you know, both of those states have pretty large air bases. I would have thought that people might retire from those air bases and stay in those states. But maybe there's other factors at work here besides this that, you know, the state needs to take into account also. I'm, you know, just looking at your sheet, the second or third page in, I guess, where you're listing the states and the national percent that they have. I don't know how we're going to, get this lined up with what you're saying when, you know, South and North Dakota don't have an income tax currently, and they're significantly less than Minnesota.
If Nelson? I may, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, Nesbitt, go ahead.
As far as North and South Dakota is concerned, if you look at the total state population there, your percentages would be higher as far as military retirees against state population. But as far as military retirees versus total retirees in the state of, in the United States, the number is lower. You're talking about two different bases.
Well, Mr. Chair and Colonel, this percentage, I'm trying to understand what this percentage is telling me then. I thought that this was the percentage of the retired vets as a percent of the national. So if there's 100,000 retired vets, you know, Florida has 9,647 of them, and Minnesota has 840, and North Dakota has 220. Just in a scale factor.
Exactly. But what I'm saying is, when you're talking about the percentages of veterans living in the state, that's the numbers. But those numbers against the population of the state changes it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair?
So, Mr. Nesbitt, then as big states like Florida and Texas and California, are their numbers kind of the same rationale? Are their numbers skewed higher for the same reason, because they have a lot more people?
Very likely, because they have a lot more retired people down there.
And a lot more people in general?
Well, they, in some cases, yes.
Mr. Chair, if I could answer that also. The base, some of these that you look up here at the top, like California, does not have any tax exemption, but there are probably 50 military bases that are in California. And if you've had the opportunity, as you do in some of the military branches, not in the Marine Corps, you get stationed at what they call the home port. You live in that community for 20 years. You buy a home, you own a home, you have your kids in school. Those are the reasons why they stay and retire in those states. That and all of the military bases also offer extra facilities and price-saving items in the commissaries and exchanges to the military retirees. That is one of the reasons why Florida and California and some of those other states have such a high percentage. It's the availability of services to the retirees that keep those people in those states.
Senator Skoy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Donne, could you help me understand then, in North Dakota, does the Air Force have a home port, or what you call it? Do those servicemen that are serving in Grand Forks, do they get stationed to that base?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I can't speak for the Air Force, but I know that there are probably a few people that, yes, they do get to go back to Grand Forks once they leave that particular base. The Air Force doesn't rotate around the world quite as much as the Marine Corps does, so you tend to stay at one base more than you would if you were in, like, the Marine Corps or the Navy, per se.
Thank you, Mr. Donne.
Thank you, sir.
Senator Vickerman, anybody else to testify?
Mr. Chair, I have one more person, and that would be okay, and that is Eric Allness. He's a government relations officer for the Minnesota National Guard, and he will shed a little, maybe different light.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Colonel Eric Allness from the Department of Military Affairs. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss this initiative, and I'll speak to the military pay portion of this bill. We look at this initiative as a benefit to encourage the enlistment in your Guard or other reserve components, and more importantly, the retention benefit for our service members. As citizens consider joining the Guard, the emotional and psychological impact of a tax-exempt income far exceeds the cost of the program to the state. It's a tangible signal to new enlistments of the value of their prospective commitment to service. The retention benefit is a much more significant aspect of this initiative. The current slate of benefits were largely developed and implemented while your Guard was a strategic reserve and basically waiting for a call in the event of a Soviet attack during the Cold War era, with incremental changes in benefits provided by the state since that time. After 9/11, your Guard and the reserve has become an operational reserve, meaning we're actively engaged in the fight. During these times of increased deployment, service members return home to family and employers and are faced with a difficult decision whether to continue their membership in the Guard or reserve. This new benefit signifies the support of the legislature and the citizens of Minnesota of the importance of the decision to remain an active drilling member of the military and sustain the strength of the Guard, providing the state and nation a viable force in times of need. I completed a survey of deployed service members, and the tax-exempt income was by far the most important retention benefit that the state could offer to troops returning from combat. I used a Likert scale rating of 1 to 7, with 1 being least important and 7 being most important. And this came out as a 6.8 on the scale. Service members near universally viewed this as a critical factor in making a decision whether to continue their membership in the reserve. The closest competing benefit was subsidized health care payments, basically paying their TRICARE premiums for them, and that received a rating of 6. So you can see that this greatly outweighed even another very important aspect that's of concern to family members. Finally, a question has been raised in the past of why should this benefit be limited to military and not be extended to other professions that nobly serve the community and state, such as fire, police, or teachers? And I can best answer this in two ways. First, no other service requires extensive separation from family and friends as the military. The 1st Brigade Combat Team will be in Iraq now for approximately 490 days before they return to their families, and that's almost 2 years total away from their families. You know, to place that in context, you can look at the 34th ID in World War II. They had the most combat days of any division. They had 520 combat days in the European Theater of Operations. Now, I draw that allusion in no way to minimize the service of the World War II veterans, but to highlight the dedication of service and commitment of the current generation of people serving in the military. As I said before, some members of the Guard and Reserve have deployed 4 times since 9/11. In support of our state and our nation. And I say state, too, because some have been doing things like airport security. Secondly, approximately 90% of the reserve components are traditional members who hold a civilian job in conjunction with their military service. These patriots serve in their civilian job and take the added step of serving their country through military service. Therefore, citizen soldiers serving in the fire, police, or as teacher roles can also benefit by the tax exemption by simultaneous membership in the Guard and Reserve. A great percentage of Minnesotans from all ways of life said they support the troops, and this is a tangible, patriotic, and visible way to show Minnesota supports the troops. I also have Staff Sergeant Jorgensen with me today, and he's available to talk about the importance of this benefit from the enlisted perspective, because truly that's what this is a benefit for our enlisted members to continue service, to re-enlist, and maintain their membership in the Guard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Thanks for the opportunity to come and speak to you today. My name is Staff Sergeant Alan Jorgensen. I am currently a drilling member out of the Austin unit, truck driver transportation. I have served a tour of duty in Iraq, and I came home, and I just want to give the perspective of what this tax exemption would mean to myself and my colleagues. One of the huge enlistment tools of the National Guard and also other services is the educational benefits. And what happens is once a soldier utilizes those great benefits and becomes, you know, highly educated, a lot of times they come in a crossroads of, should I stay in the military in the National Guard, or should I leave and get out? And I think that this tax exemption would really be a great tool to keep those soldiers who have been, you know, in the service for 10 years now, so they're highly trained by the military, a lot of expense went into training them. They're highly motivated, and also now because of their education benefits, they're highly educated, and those are the type of soldiers that you would want to keep in the military and, you know, to help with the state missions as well. So it's a huge benefit for Minnesota to keep these soldiers in the National Guard. And another reason is now that you're sitting at 10 years highly educated, you might have a civilian job that pays you more than what the National Guard salary pays. So like in my case, I have to actually budget and plan for my two-week guard camp. I have to plan and budget for you know, possible state activations because my pay drops. Now, I'm not saying that all employers do that. There are some great employers out there that would match the funds, but in my case and a lot of my colleagues' cases, we actually lose money by going to National Guard activities, and I think that's pretty bad, and I think that this tax exemption would help burden that the cost of actually serving the state of Minnesota. And also on active duty, I know I've heard reports and you know, read things about soldiers coming back from Iraq and you know, the lower enlisted ranks of private and specialists, and they have to resort to going on welfare and getting food stamps. And this is a very proud group of people, and I know that it hurts them deeply to have to do such a thing. And I would encourage this exemption to go through, and as you know, is the least that the state of Minnesota can do to help burden that as well. I think it's a great shame when a soldier who's sacrificed a lot for their country, has gone overseas and has to come home and resort to food stamps, so I think this is one way to help lessen the burden financially for them soldiers that may be Minnesota residents living and working with the services out of state as well. So that's about all I had, unless there's any questions for me. And thank you.
Thank you, Sergeant. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Colonel, I think that your discussion about the sacrifice that some of the National Guard have been giving is very, very accurate. I know that some of these young men and women served a year and a half in Afghanistan. They spent the 9 months at home. Now they're being called up. They're called up for another year and a half, which was extended. Some of that's going to be up to a year and 11 months. I think that we're going to have to, in our deliberations, see what we can do to help offset some of the income loss that the people that are currently serving our country and our state are incurring. And you know, they're not getting the income and the service that they would have made in their private lives, and they've got house payments to make. And so I think the state is going to have to pay particular attention to that area. And appreciate your testimony today.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Colonel Jorgensen, for your testimony. I really appreciate it, and I'm like Senator Scoy said, I'm very supportive of this portion of the bill, and I'm supportive of the entire bill, but I have a question for Senator Vickerman. I asked my uncle, whom I know, Senator Vickerman, you know, Harry Seaman, and he retired recently because of age from the National Guard. And I asked him about this, and he had a long career serving in the National Guard, but also is still an attorney and did fairly well for himself, has done fairly well for himself as an attorney. And he said to me, you know, Katie, there are a lot of really good people. There are so many people who need this, but I'm not one of them. And so I wonder if you've had any discussion about maybe to try to roll back some of the cost to the state of this for making it some of the income tax exemption based on other sources of income, or if you've thought about that, making it either phased in more slowly or not exempting income where retirees possibly have other sources of income coming in.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Seaman, I've had that in the back of my mind from the first day I started out with this bill because of the terrible cost, or the terrific cost that it is. But I come for this committee, and I'm going to come before this committee asking for the full exclusion, knowing that it's going to be up to this committee to decide where it goes. I think we should do it all, but that's easy for me to say when I'm not sitting on this tax committee who has to figure out how all this works. If we can't get it all, I'll be thankful for anything that we can get to help. I'm going to close, Mr. Chair, because I know you've got it busy. I'm going to close with these three things, and I want you to remember this. Now, this is speaking from me, maybe not from everybody else. I want this bill passed, and I think it should be passed for three reasons. I said, first, I think it's the right thing to do, to honor our military and our veterans. The smart thing to do, to strengthen our economy, and it pays off. I know it pays off in business development and high-paying jobs. So members, take all that into consideration when you have to work through the process. And I never served in the military, but I want to tell you this. Without them, I wouldn't be able to be here and say what I want to say in this great country. So, Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much for the patience. And I think what you do, Mr. Chair, you put this for consideration. Is that what takes place?
Senator Vickerman, the chair will lay over Senate File 160 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, thank you. For Senator Seaman, when I'm looking at the Department of Revenue fiscal note, it looks like there's a phase in of the subtractions in this bill. There is a subtract or a phase in,
I guess. And
Senator Seaman,
Senator Ortman, I was thinking more that maybe to limit the cost, we could stop the phase in or just have a portion of the subtraction and not entirely phase it in. Is what I didn't say very clearly, obviously. But I don't think that really gets at my point of there's no means test for income in this bill right now, and that and I think like Senator Moua said earlier, there are so many people who really do need this benefit, but there are others in their state who perhaps who don't need it, like my uncle, and and so maybe that's something the committee can work on before it's possible inclusion.
Sir, to that point.
Mr. Chair, I'd like our committee to do something different today. I'm wondering if it isn't possible to send this bill to the Senate floor and have the full Senate vote on this bill. If you want to call it spending, which I disagree with, but if you want to call it spending, why don't we spend our first $20 million on behalf of military folks in the state of Minnesota and to encourage Minnesota to welcome new military pensioners and retirees? Shouldn't the first $20 million we spend in this $35 billion budget be for this? And doesn't it send the right message to those folks that are overseas and to their families that the state of Minnesota supports them and will support their future? This is the right thing to do, and, Mr. Chair, I would encourage you, let the full Senate vote on this bill as a standalone bill, and let's send the message that we support these people. And, Mr. Chair, that would be a motion.
Senator Ortman, the chair has already laid over Senate Bill 160, if you listen to the tape. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator, did we vote on that? Mr. Chair, did we vote on your motion?
We're not going to vote on the motion.
We're not going to vote on motions in this committee, Mr. Chair?
We haven't voted on other bills that the chair laid on the table either.
Mr. Chair, I thought we voted on motions in this committee.
Not when the bill's laid over. Senator St. John.
Mr. Chair and members, I would concur with Senator Ortman about the floor, but what I really want to say is I hope that you and this committee can give this bill a long, long look. I think, you know, we've heard the business case, the dollar case, the work skills case, but most of all, I think it's about service and sacrifice. I mean, I look in the audience today, and there's some people here that, but for their service, you know, America's greatest generation, but for their service, we may not be here today. I did not serve same with Senator Limmer in the service. And I can go to Memorial Day ceremonies, and I can go to Veterans Day ceremonies, and I can help build memorials in Rochester, and I can do everything that I can. But I can never adequately repay our veterans. And so I hope that we might use this vehicle as a vehicle by which Minnesotans, many of whom like me, never did serve, can come to adequately, I think, express our thanks through this tax mechanism. I think it would be good for Minnesota. It would be a great, great initiative towards honoring their service. So I hope we can give it a long look.
Well, Senator St. John, it's my hope that we can, and to Senator Vickerman, that we can find some way to fit some of this into the budget target of this committee. I mean, that certainly is the chair's intent, that you know, we'll see how the discussions go with Senator Cohen and, you know, how much money the tax committee has to spend versus the finance committees. And I think it's an honorable thing to do, to try and provide, at least to Senator Stevens' points, something in here that I think shows the respect that we should show for people that have served our country. And that would certainly, I hope we can get there. Senator Scoy.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to just talk a little bit about the phase-in that's going on in here. You know, the Senate Tax Committee in the past has shown a demonstration to assess the policy, and if the policy's good, we funded it. I used the example of the single sales tax factor. We decided that was good policy. We funded it all in our bill. Now, the governor, he wanted to phase it out, and so it's taking till 2012. We're again looking at some kind of phase-in. I think that we should look at this bill in the context of what our targets are, and if it's good policy, we'll fund it, and if it isn't. But just shoving these costs out onto the future continually doesn't work. So we're going to have to make this decision within the context of this biennium, and if we can afford it, we should fund it. But to just shove the costs out onto future legislators and future citizens of the state, it's not the way we should be doing this in Minnesota.
Thank you. Senator Vickerman, thank you. Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm not going to take a lot of your time. I have Senate File 33 in front of you this morning. And it is similar in many ways to the bill that you just heard, Senator Vickerman's bill. There are some differences, however. Senator Vickerman's bill went further than what mine does. Senator Langseth, I assure you I'm not trying to outspend the majority. My bill simply exempts military pensions from income tax, not the full gamut of military pay. And I have to say that's not because I don't support Senator Vickerman's bill. I do by all means, and I would prefer, if it's possible, to see all of the military pay exempted. There has been significant military experience in my family. My husband is a partially disabled Vietnam veteran. And my son is in the Army National Guard, graduated from basic training in AIT in May of 2006, has not as yet been deployed, but has been told by his unit that he will be. So I struggle with it, and I certainly support Senator Vickerman's bill, but realize some of the financial constraints that we do have. I also have to add that my mother is 89 years old and on a very fixed income. And my mom would tell you to be careful not to overtax young families for the benefit of retirees like herself. And that's why I'm not asking for an exemption for CEOs with six-figure pensions. I'm not asking for an exemption for state government or any kind of government employees. All I'm asking for is an exemption for military pension persons, retired pension persons, that our average pension is approximately $20,000. They don't make a lot of money on these pensions. They're not like some of our retired CEOs. But the biggest difference is that these folks, as Mr. Donay said, have had to move their families around frequently. My brother-in-law, who is retired Air Force and has chosen to live in the state of Washington, moved approximately every 4 years in his 30-year career. His children didn't really have a place that they would say, yep, this was home for most of our lives. I had the luxury of living in the same farmhouse from the time I was born until I graduated from high school and foolishly couldn't wait to leave. These guys have served in theaters of war like some of us here have never experienced, so they've been through some difficult things. The biggest thing is they've served us so that we can live the way we do, so that we can sit here in our nice clothes and make these decisions. And I realize they're tough decisions, but I would hope that we make them recognizing the fact that these folks have done something for us. They have given up a major portion of their life in service to their country because they value the freedoms that we have, and we have them only because of them. But after they're finished with their military service, they don't quit. These are folks that when they retire, they return to their communities, and they run the VFWs, and they run the American Legions. And they run the charitable gambling operations that take place in those. And by running those charitable gambling operations, which isn't always easy, there are some big headaches. They in turn give computers to our schools. They build ballparks for our kids. They put our flags out on holidays. They give each one of us here a flag for our office if we want it. They do so many things in the communities in which they live that are far away and above beyond what they take home in their military retirement that I don't think we can thank them enough. And I'm going to end with that, Mr. Chair. And I'm not going to bring up a bunch of witnesses because I don't want to be redundant and take a lot of your time. I just want to emphasize how much we should appreciate what these folks have done. And I don't want you to overspend, but I do want you to look at priorities, and I think our military veterans are a priority. Thank you.
Senator Wergen, this is a much more modest approach, and I appreciate you bringing it forward because I think this committee does want to consider doing something for veterans that are retired, and maybe somehow we can craft some kind of a hybrid proposal here out of the number of bills that are in front of us. So thank you for bringing it forward.
Mr. Chair, I would also like to echo what Senator Scoey said. If we do this, let's do it. Let's not push it out for future legislators. I think that's one of the most ridiculous things that we do. We don't bite the bullet and vote on the things that should be done and do them today and fund them. We push them out into the future. So I would encourage you to take a look at whatever we can do and do it now. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wergen. The chair lays over for possible inclusion Senate File 33. Thank
Mr. Chair, we're not going to vote on that one either, just for the record.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Scoey.
We will be voting on these initiatives when we're putting the omnibus bill together. Is that not correct?
Everything in the omnibus bill will be voted on before it goes to the floor. But we're not going to play a game here every week of not laying bills on the table for possible inclusion, because if they're not laid on the table for possible inclusion, then they're not even going to be considered as part of the omnibus bill. So I do think we need to lay them over and try to put together an overall package. Everybody will get a vote on everything. If there's something that you want considered, that it's certainly going to get a vote on it.
But
if we don't lay them on the table, then they're not going to get considered for possible inclusion.
Well, and
Senator Scoey.
Mr. Chair, is the February forecast out yet? Do we know how much money the Senate Tax Committee is going to have?
Senator Scoey, it'll be out next Wednesday.
So at the very least, we should wait till after we see what's going on there, I would think.
Senator Ortman?
Mr. Chair, I know you're doing what the plan was. You're following the plan, which is to lay all the bills over and do your best. And I believe in the sincerity of your comments and those of the other members of this committee that we are going to do our best to include this in our budget. And I appreciate that. Please understand that I do. But every now and then, a bill comes along that transcends our process and the way we do things around here. And this is one of those bills that should transcend our process and one that we should look at a little differently, because I think everybody in this room agrees we should fix this problem and we should make this change. And I think that we can ask our colleagues in the Senate to vote on this bill and see if this is our priority or not. And I believe it is, but maybe others believe it is not. But I think it should be, and I think the full Senate should have the opportunity to do that. And it is a bit of a struggle to sit over here in the minority, as Senator Langseth has pointed out, and see a bill like this that does transcend it and get lost in the process. And it rings pretty hollow to the people here in this room that someday we're going to look at this and we're going to make a decision about whether we can afford it or not. They're here now. And I think that we owe it to them to say, when this issue does, as I believe, transcend what we're doing, I think we owe it to them to say we will consider this in the full Senate. And I am disappointed that we won't, but I respect the authority of the chair to do what he's doing today.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Pogemiller.
Chairman, Senator Ortman, I don't fundamentally disagree with your point. And I'll just say for the record, I fundamentally think investment in early childhood is more important than this bill. I just do. And I think most veterans would agree with that. So that bill's not going to move first. So why should this bill? Senator Ortman, do you think this bill is more important than investment in early childhood education?
That is a very good question, Senator Pogemiller. The reason why it's good is we don't do early childhood funding in the Senate Tax Committee. We're the only committee that's going to look at this bill and make a decision on this. And that's why I say let's send it to the floor, Senator Pogemiller.
Well, we got Senator Day, Senate File 95.
Mr. Chairman, I hate to follow that act, I'll tell you that, because being a veteran, and that was a tough one. You could have that one every morning first, Mr. Chairman, because I think that would... That would
Senator, we're all going to make very important decisions, and we all need time to contemplate what the priorities are. And
Mr. Chairman,
generally, my experience has shown that the more time we take on things, kind of the better outcomes we get. Senator Day, thank
Mr.
you.
Chairman,
welcome to the tax committee.
I have a bill that probably is, after listening to what was here, probably isn't as high a priority even for myself, but it's my bill, and it's been a something that we in the state of Minnesota have been kicking around for years and years and years. And I realize it'll cost money, and I'll get into that. But basically, the bill exempts cities and counties and townships from sales tax. And I've always thought, I think it was 1992, that we actually started charging a sales tax. And I personally have always believed from the first day, actually, that we put it in, that just isn't right, and it makes for a tough decision, and in some cases, where if people are getting local government aid, it even it really compounds what we're doing, because we're in my communities of take three of my communities of like Owatonna and Faribault, it's costing them like $180,000 to $220,000. For each community each year, and then of course we're involved with the local government aid, and we send the local government aid back to them. Same time we're charging a sales tax. But the main thing is, even we have to realize that this is taxpayers. These are all taxpayer dollars, and we have exempted, you know, some fire trucks and some peace officer vests, and you know, there are some exemptions, but. This one would exempt everything in a sales tax. We also know that if we're building stadiums, we always exempt when the Twins and the Gopher football stadium. The other thing is that when we went through our $4.5 billion deficit, we all know, where did we go? We went back to cities and counties and school districts and shifted some money and took money and whatever to balance our budgets. And I think, you know, now is a time that we can step up to the plate and change that. We're one of very few states that tax purchases from in cities and counties. One of the very few, and some of them even have it in their constitution that they can't do it. But I do know that this, and I'll try and answer the question before it even is put to me. This bill would cost us probably $90 million to do. And as you were just sitting here talking to this other group about, $15 or $20 million, I realized that there's a hefty price tag. But I'll also tell you, instead of new programs that we're all either going to propose and try and do, and we're going to try and, it would seem to me that we would be better off if we did have an extra $800 million or $1 billion to rectify some of the massive tax policy that we do have in the state and get it right. And I think this is one of the bills that that we should do. It is something that treats every city, if it's a small city, you know, or a large city, or a large county, small county, it treats everybody on an equal basis, depending on their purchases. With me, and I have a couple testifiers, and I know you're pinched for time here, so maybe we'll let the cities and people from the county just briefly, shortly, in a short message to you, tell you their opinions, if that'd be all right.
Thank you, Senator Day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Day, for bringing this bill forward. Members of the committee, my name is Jennifer O'Rourke. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities, and we are here today in support of Senator Day's bill on that would provide a sales tax exemption to all local units of government, adding us to the list of exemptions already in statute and the school districts. As you well know, this has been a longstanding position for the League of Cities and the other city groups that are around the Capitol. We understand that there is an expensive fiscal note on this, and you have a lot of priorities in front of you as you make your way through the rest of the session. But we'd just like to be on record supporting the ideas behind Senator Day's bill and all the other bills that have been introduced. I know there's other general exemption bills that have been introduced, and I know there are pieces of legislation dealing with construction projects, public safety buildings, county courthouses, transportation projects, roads and bridges, wastewater treatment facilities, and emergency response equipment that would be smaller chunks, if you will, of getting at this big expense for local governments. That's all I have, and I stand for questions.
Ms. O'Rourke, I don't think any of us here, well, Senator Langseth was, I guess, was maybe the only one that might have been here in 1991 when this was done. And it seems to me.
Senator Marty.
Well, Senator Marty was here, too.
And Senator Day,
yeah. Okay. Okay. Well, maybe you guys can answer this then. But was there, cities were given an option during them difficult budget times of whether to have their local government aid cut or to have a sales tax on their local purchases. And I believe cities selected tax us, don't cut our aid. Ms. O'Rourke, is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, I believe you are correct with that assessment. I wasn't here either, but I've done a little history and talking to some folks on that. And if I might add to where you're going with this, I believe what I was told at the time, they expected to raise about $60 million by adding cities and counties and townships to the sales tax portion. And that price tag has kind of gone up over the years.
Mr. Work, it's always dangerous to question where that chair is going, because my question is, was there another reason relative to some federal money that cities chose to take the sales tax, that by taking the sales tax they actually received a little bit of more federal money And if you don't know the answer to that, could you check for me? Because I've heard that there were when the sales tax went on, there actually was a small federal benefit of federal revenue coming to the state that offset at least a small part of the sales tax liability. So if anybody knows the answer to that, Mr. Rourke, can you check for me and see if there is some? If we took this off, would cities actually lose a small amount of federal money that they're currently receiving?
Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to look into that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Skoy.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Rourke, you mentioned that originally this was intended to raise $60 million back in 1991. And, you know, I know around here we don't like to recognize inflation, but I've been arguing that it does occur whether we want it to or not. And there's this little rule for financing called the Law 72 where you take the amount of interest or inflation there is and divide it into 72, and it'll tell you how many years it takes to double the money. Well, if you take 4% for an inflation rate or 3.5% and you divide it into 72, you know, you're looking at that doubling in about 20 or 20-some years, something like that. So it's been 16 years since 1991, so that $60 million would have gone up by that much just because of inflation. And, you know, I know we are struggling this year with how we're going to deal with this and whether we include it in our forecast or not, but, you know, I just want to keep telling folks that it does occur and we should be recognizing it.
Mr. Matthews?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Joe Matthews. I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties and also speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Intercounty Association today. And I'll just echo Ms. O'Rourke's comments. We support the bill. We also support the other bills that may be coming forward that tackle smaller portions, such as the construction materials for roads or courthouses, et cetera. And with that, I'll just answer any questions. But I think everything's been
said. Senator Day.
And Mr. Chairman, we thank you for listening to our bill. And we, you know, there might be a some portion down the line that this is something that might have to be phased in over many years also. You know, maybe we can, you know, ratchet down a percent or such every year and have something that would take effect. But it would seem, my initial reaction when I looked at the bill and realizing that it does cost us a considerable amount of money, I was trying to rationalize how, if we can't get a hold of this when we have a surplus, a large surplus of whatever we might have, then we're probably never going to get a hold of it. And that will mean that we will have this. If you explain it to any coffee clutch in the state, they would tell you it's pretty ludicrous, especially outside of the metropolitan area. And the reason I say that is because that's where we're sending $400,000 in local government aid, and then we're collecting back $180,000. I mean, it's just, and in all, you know, you buy a, and so the city's an LGA, of course, it's there, but let's face it, every other city, no matter how large or how small, this is a huge price tag. So we, maybe there's a way we can phase it in over a period of time, and I wanted to bring it forward basically just because it's such a obvious bad policy, and I was here when we put it in, so it's part of my problem. And if we can't rectify it, people are going to be sitting here 20 years ago and say, hey, I bought a box of pencils in Worthington and they charge the sales tax on it, and it doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Senator Day, do you remember if you voted for it?
No, I don't. Today was the first time that I knew that what year it was, because I couldn't remember the year, but I knew it was in the first years that I got here.
Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Day, there's actually two competing things going on here, as I recall this issue. One is it does look like it's inefficient to basically have organizations that public entities paying a sales tax, because it looks like, all right, you pay here, you get it back there. But the flip side is,
I remember there is a policy argument that says, well, why shouldn't a government agency pay the same taxation as a private entity for the same good? Because that's an efficiency argument. That then says they should
be faced with the same decision as a private group is.
And
So to me, it's not quite as clear that this is bad public policy to do it this way. I think it, you can think about it several ways, but I do remember the argument from the private sector that, you know, City Hall should pay the same as we have to pay because we're trying to provide the same services in some instances.
Yeah. We all have had, you get together with a group of people in presently, and they're talking about their property tax. And you sit and talk to 10 people that are having coffee with you on a property tax, and you say, well, do you realize that we pay $15 billion towards schools? And they go, what? I says, yeah, do you realize that we pay $15 billion towards your schools? A lot of people don't realize that. Then I say, in greater Minnesota, do you realize that half of your budget isn't on your property tax? It comes from local government aid. Now, it's all taxpayer money. Don't get me wrong. I don't think the state's any better than the local. But it's surprising to me how people that are sitting around a table don't understand we've complicated it so much that they don't even understand who's paying what, and yet their property taxes are going up, and they get nervous, even though if you look at it, probably 7 years ago, if Senator Scully was, I think, is right on the inflation thing, that 7 years ago the taxes were probably the same, and at least in some of my cities. But yet at the same time, with increases going up, they feel their taxes are really jumping. And so it's, you know, this is just one of the things that kind of helps straighten it out. The sick tax was another one, and I don't know if somebody will have that one, but maybe some years when we do have some extra dollars, instead of brand new programs that will come out and say, and we're going to put money into all these different things, and that's all well and good, but maybe somewhere we also should straighten some of these things out.
Senator DeBolt.
I thank you.
Thank you.
Senator DeBolt. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize if I wasn't quite focused in if we spent some time on this already, but Senator Day, if you could just first confirm that I understand the exemption piece. That's the piece where if a good or service can also be provided in the private sector. Liquor stores, I think, are the example. So the way that works, if a city, you know, buys materials to build a liquor store, a municipally owned liquor store, they would pay the sales tax on that. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. And the philosophy behind that, is that just for some of the reasons that Senator Pogemiller said, we don't want to provide inordinate advantage to the public provision of that service or good in relationship to the private?
It would seem to me, and I, you know, this is something both you live in Minneapolis and you could ask them, but if the city of Minneapolis is paying out, and I can't imagine, but what if Owatonna is $180,000, Minneapolis is probably millions of dollars, and at the same time we're saying, okay, but what we're going to do is we're going to also send you back millions of dollars in local government aid. The rationale behind all of that, there's some areas where I have some problems with. I agree that we put the system in, and I will research how I voted on it. But yeah,
I'm just specifically asking about this. I think I understand now the private business or the kinds of goods and services that would be otherwise or could be otherwise provided by private business. Do we know, do we have a sense, I can't pull it off the fiscal note, how that affects the fiscal note, what difference there would be otherwise? Maybe I do have a bill that is a complete exemption. Maybe we can just, you know, do the addition, we'll find out the difference that makes.
Senator Day, it's another good idea.
Well, I don't know about that, but it's better than I've had for a few days anyway. So.
Thank you, Senator Day.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Not to belabor it, we could whip on this one for a long time, but, you know, Senator Scoy did talk about good policy, and I think this is one we ought to have some discussion on this as well sometime and see where we really are. I mean, we can all bring examples forward which sound fairly ridiculous, and as we present them, but the idea of taxing a tax is something I've never understood.
Chair lays over Senate File 95 for possible inclusion. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have Senate File 179. And Mr. Chair and members, what this bill would do is it would extend to nonprofit employers the same sort of tax benefit that's available to for-profit employers that subsidize their employees' purchase of transit passes. The transit pass program that people are probably the most familiar with is the Metro Pass program that's provided by Metro Transit, though this would be a statewide program. It's not specific to Metro Transit or Metro Pass. So if an employer, a nonprofit employer, if an employer anywhere in the state provides some benefit to their employees with respect to their group purchase of transit passes, they get a tax benefit from their income. Of course, nonprofit employers are don't pay taxes. So what this bill would do is would allow them to participate by giving them some financial consideration for that purpose. Mr. Chair, there I think I saw Mr. Rundquist whispering here. There is no current fiscal note, but I think there was a decision made to go ahead with that. There is some, we do have a fiscal note from previous years in which this was considered. I will say, though, that I hope there's some real question about last year's fiscal note. The number we think, and we believe we have strong evidence that it's far too big. And some of the evidence, we can get into that later, some of the evidence we have is from previous fiscal notes from when this program was established in the first place, overestimated by a factor of 4 or 5. What the cost of the state would be in the tax credit program. So with that, Mr. Chair, I think that's a nice overview of what we seek to do in the bill, and we have a few folks who would like to explain their interest.
Senator Dibble, and to the witnesses, if we could just keep it to a couple of minutes, that
very
would be
brief.
Helpful. We got two more bills yet. So.
Yeah, we have Marsha Abner, Mr. Chair, from the Council of Nonprofits.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Marsha Avner. I'm the Public Policy Director at the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. We're supportive of this measure. We think it's good public policy. It's an incentive to transit use. Efficiencies are achieved. Congestion is mitigated. I think we all know the importance of dealing with the environmental situation. For nonprofits, this is an opportunity to have access and fairness in this system that we haven't had before. Nonprofits in Minnesota make up 10% of the employment economy. Many of our employees in the sector are dependent on transit. Many of the employees in our sector enjoy, if that's the right word, lower wages than people in other sectors. I think we've shared with members of the legislature the Minnesota Nonprofit Economy Report, which shows how nonprofits are positioned relative to the public and private sector. And indeed, we do have lower wage workers. This is an important benefit. It will provide an incentive to employees that we think is valuable. In my own organization, we have 3 people who are fully dependent on transit. We do not currently offer them a benefit, and I can speak for my own organization that the passage of this legislation would make a difference, and this would be included in a benefit package. Keep in mind how important this is to the very people who are providing core services in our community. In the metropolitan area alone, there are 2,641 nonprofit employment sites and 133,000 jobs. And those are 2005 numbers. We think there's a slight increase. Those are jobs in the healthcare, education, human services industries. And so we would urge you to support this measure to provide a level playing field for nonprofits along with the private sector to bring us into this opportunity and to do everything that you can to encourage the efficiencies and the effectiveness of strengthening our transit system.
Thank you.
We have Dave Van Haddam from Transit for Livable Communities, who in a previous job actually promoted the Metro Pass program to Metro employers, so he has a lot of detailed knowledge about how this works if folks have questions about that as well.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. As Senator Dibble alluded to, I now work for Transit for Livable.
Mr. Van Hattem, could your name for the record?
Dave Van Hattem, with Transit for Livable Communities.
Thank you.
And I'm going to speak mostly this morning from my experience prior to that employment. I worked for 6 years in the metro, both downtown Minneapolis and in the suburban areas, promoting the combination of transit carpooling incentives through employers, getting employers to promote these options to their employees. And I want to applaud you for creating the state corporate transit income tax credit. It's been a huge tool in getting employers on board and having them both subsidize the bus pass, but equally importantly, communicate to their employees that the bus is an option, that there's other employees that use the bus, and it's a realistic option as an alternative to driving and using a parking space. Just quickly, a little bit of background. The MetroPass program, which was hand-in-hand with the state tax credit, started in 1998, and the first employer on board was American Express. In 2002, there were 50 employers in the program, and now there's over 150. And I note the number in 2002 because that was also the year that this combination of programs, Metro Transit program, in partnership with the private employers, in partnership with the state of Minnesota, received the Governor's Award for Pollution Prevention. At these employment sites, we saw very significant shifts from people driving alone, about 25% shift of people driving alone to using the bus. And that translated into 8,000 fewer drive-alone trips every day and 1.6 million gallons of gas that weren't consumed in our state, strictly as a result of that program when it was in its infancy. So we think this is a critical program to addressing congestion, to working with employers, provide a nice employee benefit in the transit and commuting realm, and we think that the missing piece is that it's not equitable right now. It's not available to nonprofit organizations. And just one final note, I would say in by no means is this a windfall to the nonprofit sector. In the same way that we built up participation in the private sector, we sit at that moment with the nonprofit sector. The large nonprofits don't currently, very few of them are in the MetroPass program. The ones that aren't tending to subsidize. So this would be very effective public policy in terms of leveraging that public-private partnership, getting greater private investment in our bus system and working together to get more bus riders, less congestion, and a stronger economy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, we have Jim Urkel from the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jim Urkel, and I'm with Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. As you've heard, Metro Transit's MetroPass program has been highly successful more than since its inception and in a negotiated deal in 1998 with American Express, now Ameriprise. It's grown to more than 150 employers. 24,000 of their employees are now using MetroPass cards and are using are riding on Metro Transit buses and trains. They represent they take about 8.7% of all the rides on Metro Transit, and they also provide about 25% of all the fare proceeds that Metro Transit gets. The 30% credit against the corporate income tax has certainly encouraged many businesses to take part in the program and help cover some of the cost of the transit passes for their employees. However, as you've heard, it's only available for for-profit businesses. We're particularly interested in seeing that expanded to nonprofits as well. Nonprofits employ more than 250,000 people in Minnesota, slightly more than 50% of them are in the Twin Cities. In addition, they represent some of the region's largest employers, including three of the five largest private sector employers in the city of St. Paul. We support Senate File 179 because it would help level the playing field between for-profit and nonprofit businesses, and it's been proven successful in broadening the use of transit. More importantly, though, it would be one of the many small steps that Minnesota can start taking to begin addressing or dealing with the economic and environmental costs of global warming. Transportation represents about one-third of all the emissions of greenhouse gases in the state. This bill would encourage commuters and others to begin shifting their travel from automobiles to transit, and transit represents a much less polluting form of transportation on a per passenger mile basis. So it would be one of many steps that we could take to begin addressing that global warming problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Dibble, in the information that you distributed, it looks like the for-profit companies can get some tax savings, both state and federal. Can the nonprofits receive some federal savings under the federal law? Are they currently receiving some savings there, and it's just the state that's not conforming?
Mr. Chair, let me answer make a different point first, and then I don't know the answer to the second point, but I suspect the answer is no. Employees who receive a transit, who are able to participate in a group sales transit benefit, transit pass benefit, or receive a parking benefit, can use those dollars on a pre-tax basis, at least federally. I'm not sure that there's a pre-tax benefit for employees for state income. I'm sure
it applies to both, actually.
Okay, so both state and federal, though that's a pre-tax benefit to employees. I think similarly, as is the case with the state tax circumstance for nonprofit employers, they don't pay the federal taxes either. So the answer to your original question is no. Is that correct?
But I believe that's true.
David knows.
The federal tax benefit that's referred to there is simply that pre-tax option. So whether you work for a for-profit or a nonprofit, as an individual, you're paying federal taxes. So you can receive transit. You're paying it as an employee. You're paying for that bus pass, but you can pay for it on a pre-tax basis, whether you work in the nonprofit sector or the for-profit.
But there's not a corporate tax savings. This reads like there's a corporate tax savings.
At the federal level.
At the federal level.
There is not.
There is not. Okay. That helps. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, maybe Mr. Van Hatten. Remember last year when we tried this, they had a massive fiscal note, and I know there's no fiscal note here yet. I was told that's because they'll be getting one soon. But I was just asking Senate Counsel if this was the same bill we tried last time. But I'm looking, and I'm wondering if this is different. Did we try last time to make it a refund for everyone, and that the Revenue Department was claiming that it was high because all these other businesses that weren't paying taxes were going to claim it? And so by limiting it to a credit for the for-profits and for the nonprofits, a refund, is that the change, or is there no change in revenues, just deciding it wasn't so expensive?
I'll take a crack at it, Mr. Chair, Senator Marty. And I think Jim Merkel can help us a little bit as well. But our critique of last year's fiscal note is that it was too high. Way too high. $370,000 in the first year, $510,000 in the second year, and $540,000 probably going up from there. And we think they were just counting, they were way overcounting the level of participation. This, I believe, is the same bill as last year. And I know that we've been engaged with the Department of Revenue to maybe provide more information to them. When the original fiscal note for MetroPass was developed back when it was first created, I think their revenue estimate was way north of $1 million, and it turned out to be less than around $400,000. But Jim Merkel illuminated me to some of these facts this morning, so he knows more.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, the bill last year would have created a single refund mechanism. It would have eliminated the corporate tax credit. That was at the request of the Department of Revenue. I think this time around they decided that they wanted to have them separate. But to the point of the fiscal impact, right now, with about 150,000 employees that are eligible to take part, with 24,000 of them actually using the MetroPass cards, the Department of Revenue's tax expenditure report shows that it represents about $400,000 a year as a cost to the state. It's hard for us to understand how they could come up with a much higher number, which would have to suggest that every single nonprofit employee would be participating at the same level at the same dollar amounts. And so that's part of the problem with those assumptions.
But Mr. Urkel, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Urkel, but in other words, so last year what we tried was a refund across the board, and that's where they came in. So you're, even though you haven't seen it, you're optimistic this year they can't do that because you're this one would only expand it to the nonprofits.
Mr. Chair, Turkle. Senator Marty, yes, I believe that's the case.
Well, Senator Dibble, tax committees for a long time have found some frustration in fiscal notes that we receive, so hopefully this will come more in line this year. And members, we should have that fiscal note, so it should be in your packets by Monday, I believe. So, Senator Dibble, any further?
No, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I would just offer, and I don't have a lot of experience in here, but I do work for a fairly large nonprofit in Rochester, and they enacted a bus pass program probably 15 years ago. Of the 30,000 people, I'm just going to guess perhaps maybe 4,000 or so ride buses every day, not only within the city, but going into outlying communities. If you're in the city, it's 100%. It's a free bus pass. If you're going out to Casson or Dodge Center or Preston, it's a 50% program. But when they got into that and started looking at the cost of this program versus the cost of owning, maintaining parking facilities, be it the surface lots or ramps, the bus pass program in and of itself pays for itself.
Yeah, Senator Sundrum, I know of another program like that up at Duluth at the University of Minnesota. They offer free Duluth transit passes to all of their students. I'm not sure about the faculty, but for the same reason is that they figure it's cheaper than having to tie up some land on their footprint for additional parking. So, Chair lays over Senate File 690.
Mr. Chair,
179.
To make one minor technical note in defense of our students, the cost of the Duluth bus pass is somewhat also offset by student fees. So there is some source. There is a little bit of cash from. It's all one big pot. It is a huge benefit, and students love it. It's great.
The chancellor tells me that it's free.
we had some significant focus on that in St. Cloud when we had our transit hearing up there.
Senate File 179 is laid over for possible inclusion. Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. Chair and members.
Mr. Chairman, members, Senate File 697 is a fairly simple bill. It, in the omnibus tax bill in 05, $750,000 was appropriated for the foreign trade zone, and by and large, it's for the one in the Rosemount area. I think there are federal, is this the only foreign trade zone in the state? Mr. Verbrugge. This is Jamie Verbrugge, who's the Rosemont city manager, and he's a lead on this economic development zone. And we can get into this, but there's this foreign trade zone. And $750,000 was appropriated to deed. At the time, with that commissioner, after the bill had passed, there was a request to spend $200,000 of that $750,000 to do an economic feasibility study. And the commissioner at the time, Mr. Innes at the time, said, fine, that made sense, but he said, I'll check with the chairs. And so he checked with myself and Senator and Representative Abrams, and we both said that makes sense. That fits the spirit of what we were trying to do. Since then, they've not expended all that money, but they've now apparently determined that it's $250,000 they will need to do this economic development study. And with a new commissioner coming, the suggestion was maybe we got to just verify in the law that that's an okay expenditure so as not to put the current commissioner in a position of saying, well, can I do that? And so the thought was just come and just make it explicit that that would be okay to do it. And so that's all this bill does. Mr. Verbrugge can give you a little more information on that trade zone and the work that has currently been done on the study. Apparently, they have to change consultants and so forth, but I think a word or two from Mr. Verbrugge might clarify. But the bill itself is really just a clarification, so the department is just comfortable saying, fine, that's fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Pogemiller, Senators. Senator Pogemiller is correct that what's being requested here, I think, is simply a codification of the agreement by the parties last year just to create a cleaner audit trail of where the state funds for this project are going. I believe many of you were on the tax committee a couple years ago when this initial legislation was enabled. The foreign trade zone, the Greater Metro Area Foreign Trade Zone number 119, serves the Twin Cities and greater area outstate, largely the southern half of the state. Foreign trade zones are operated under the auspices of the United States Department of Commerce, and the intent behind this project, as I believe most of you are familiar, is to create a facility that will gather a critical mass of air cargo that is currently being trucked to the Chicago area and to other airports for international destinations. We have about 80 to 85% of all of our locally or regionally produced goods that are being distributed worldwide that are being trucked to other places to do that. We don't have an originating flight at MSP. Now, in order to make sure that this concept is feasible, the legislature required that a business plan be prepared and specific answers be provided on the financial viability of this concept and the timeliness of when state subsidy would no longer be necessary. So we have retained consultants. We are just starting the work. We had our kickoff meeting last Friday, as a matter of fact. We expect to wrap up the study about September of this year, and we'll be reporting progress back to the legislature before next year. You may also recall that we had an amendment to the legislation last year that extended our timeline from the initial timeline that was set. So we have until June 30th of 2008 to establish the International Economic Development Zone. And folks may be wondering, why is the Rosemount City Administrator here talking about foreign trade zone? Rosemount was selected as the host community for this facility if indeed the project is viable. And in that capacity, I'm acting as the project manager working with the foreign trade zone. Stand for questions.
Thank you. Senator Pogamiller, anything further? Chair lays over Senate File 697 for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Senate File 630. Senator Price.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members.
Good morning.
I thought maybe if a senator wasn't on the committee, they could kind of get moved up on the agenda. I'm just kidding. Appreciate that very much. I'm here today, and I have a single-page handout that's being distributed, and I apologize. The reference to the Senate file is the incorrect number. It's supposed to be 630, not 640. That's my own typing error. This particular occasion for me, I'm Len Price of the Minnesota Conservation Corps' Executive Director. I'm speaking today on behalf of my own program, a nonprofit youth conservation program, but I'm also speaking on behalf of the other AmeriCorps programs in the state of Minnesota. There are about 1,000 young people who are enrolled in AmeriCorps programs in our state each year, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But Senate File 630 is really a proposal for a tax cut. We appreciate Senator Bach authoring it. It would exempt the AmeriCorps Education Award that an enrolled member receives upon completion of service from Minnesota income tax. An education award of $4,725 is earned upon completion of a year of national service by an individual enrolled in an AmeriCorps program. You can only earn a maximum of two such education awards in your lifetime. One of them could conceivably be a partial award for a reduced term of service. And the award can be used for up to 7 years after you complete your service. And you can use it either to repay outstanding student loans that you've incurred or for expenses incurred after you do your service to attend a post-secondary institution. The award, since its inception, has always been subject to federal tax. Typically, an individual that serves in an AmeriCorps National Service Program receives a modest, and I mean modest, living allowance. It usually averages about $900 a month. This allowance really only provides for basic living expenses at best. The education award is like an extra thing to be incentive to be involved in the program. And when you use it, in the year that you actually use the education award, that's the year that it becomes taxable. So if a member uses this award immediately after the year of service, they have tax consequences from both the state and federal governments. And we hear stories of some of the AmeriCorps members who actually have to take out loans to pay the tax on this education award that's designed to provide opportunity, not cause financial burden. So the exemption proposed in this bill was actually once part of Minnesota law. It was effective for 1997, but somewhere along the line it was sunsetted. I'm sorry, I'm not prepared to tell you how it happened or the precise incident in which it happened. I suspect it was in 2003 or 2004 when there was an effort on the part of the legislature to find as many sources of revenue as possible to balance the budget. It was unfortunate when the law was passed in 97 that the reference to the U.S. code citation was actually wrong. And so this bill not only would reinstate the exemption, but it would correct the citation to the appropriate one. The education award is beneficial to AmeriCorps individuals because it helps them in their pursuit of a higher education and training program, which is a good and wise investment for everybody in Minnesota, but especially the workforce. And then it also is an economic boost to institutions of higher learning because it injects millions of dollars into the revenue stream of those colleges and universities in Minnesota. If you flip the page over, the AmeriCorps director for Minnesota, who is with us here today, Mr. Robert M. Jackson, his exact title is State Program Director, Minnesota State Office for the Corporation for National and Community Service, prepared this chart to illustrate since 1995 through 2007, at least in terms of who's enrolled at this point, what that economic impact is. It shows the number of members in each of those years, the number of actual payments that were used, where the award was actually used, and then how much the aggregate payment amount was. And bottom line, you can see that over that period of time, $26 million plus has actually been brought into the state colleges, universities, and private institutions in Minnesota as revenue because it was used to pay for those expenses of those students. The bottom chart is a chart our finance director put together to show some examples of tax incidents for an individual based upon their income and whether they're single or married. I have with me today two of Corps members who served in the Minnesota Conservation Corps, and I'd like to have them have an opportunity to testify briefly. The first person is on the far right, and it's Candace McElroy, no relation to the Commissioner of Deed.
And only physically on the far right.
Ms. McElroy, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Candace McElroy. I attended the University of St. Thomas, graduating with a double major in Business Management and Environmental Studies in May 2003. Following my formal education, I sought an opportunity to get my hands dirty, so to speak. The Minnesota Conservation Corps provided this opportunity through field work in the natural resources field in the state of Minnesota. I served an extended term of 15 months with MCC, working on projects including invasive species removal, trail building, stream bank restoration, and also did a stint in emergency response work in Louisiana following Hurricane Katrina. As a Corps member, I received a living allowance of $1,066 gross, which equated to about $893 per month in take-home pay. The stipend covered basic necessities such as food, housing, and transportation, but in most cases did not provide extra money for savings on a monthly basis. Upon the completion of my 1,700 hours of service, I received the full AmeriCorps Education Award of $4,725. I used the award for loan repayment immediately following my service term. Since the Education Award is considered taxable income, I ended up owing $411 in federal tax and $113 in state tax for tax year 2005. Although this sum does not sound significant to most, it proved to be a financial burden at the time, given my former limited income generation. I was fortunate enough to have a relatively inexpensive living arrangement, family to assist me in the interim, and surprisingly no credit card debt from my Corps member in college days. Some of my peers were not as fortunate, and thus paying this amount following their service proved to be an even greater financial burden. AmeriCorps programs try to ensure that the Corps member is adequately rewarded for their time spent in service, or at least not to make them financially worse off after the completion of their term. The stipend is intended to cover basic living expenses. You receive loan forbearance during your term of service and the education award as a reward for completing your full term. However, since the education award is not tax exempt, Corps members often owe money to the state. This financial burden may actually act as a deterrent when recruiting Corps members that AmeriCorps programs actually intend to attract and assist. Thank you.
And also in the middle here is Jeff West, who served with MCCE for two complete terms.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jeff West, and as Len just stated, I served two full terms of service with the Minnesota Conservation Corps. Prior to joining MCC in 2004, I graduated from Gustavus with a double major in environmental studies and geography. Unlike Candace, I was fortunate enough not to have any student loans. So upon completion this past December, I have almost $10,000 in education awards that I have to use, except I don't have the loans that many people have. So my plan is to use them for future education, which I believe a lot of people, several people this past year in MCC are currently going back to school. And it becomes really difficult coming out of a program like MCC. Numbers been thrown around already about how much we make, but we don't really make money. You basically break even while you're at MCC. And if you come out of that and you want to go directly back to school, you want to start using these education awards, all of a sudden you've got, an extra $1,000 of taxes that you have to pay. And that's an extra $1,000 that you're going to have to earn working a job while you're still trying to go to school. And that's a really hard thing for people to do. And I just think it's really important that we look at this and try to help some people out who are trying to go back to school or trying to, further their education to get better jobs. It's really important for young people to be able to do that.
Mr. West, what kind of work did you do for MCC?
I did, Mr. Chairman, many of the same things Candace did. I started as a Corps member. After about 8 months, I actually got bumped up to a crew leader. We did many of the same type of projects, exotic species removal. We did some prescribed burning. We've done wildfires. I went on the same trip to Louisiana to do Katrina relief. We've done some construction work, building boardwalks. You name it, it's all sorts of environmental service.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee?
So, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Price, I like the idea, and so I was just curious, judging from fiscal note, it's a little over $200 per recipient in effect in the tax burden right now. The state portion?
The estimate that the Corporation for National Service is making is that the fiscal impact would probably be somewhere between $100,000 and $250,000 a year, depending on the number of people that actually use the award and then the tax bracket that they're in. And Bob Jackson with the corporation is here if you'd like to verify that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just looking at the fiscal note, it looks like they claim 470 taxpayers for their estimate and 100,000. So they're estimating just over 200, I guess, per person.
Thank you. I did not see the fiscal note.
Okay. It's a good issue.
The cost members on the fiscal note is about $100,000 per year to the general fund. And you can almost think of it as tuition relief.
Right.
So, any other questions from the committee?
I got a bill on
transport. Senator Price, anything further?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for authoring the bill and for giving us the time to tell our story. And we tried to get other AmeriCorps programs to be here today to testify as well, but we were not able to organize that. So.
Senator Price, thank you. The chair lays over Senate File 630 for possible inclusion.
Should we move this right to the floor?
Yeah. Consent calendar, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, consent
calendar.
Members,
trying to help out.
On Tuesday, we didn't have a fiscal note on Senator Murphy's bill, 454. It's here if you want to take a look at it before you leave.
Mr. Chair.
Members, we're going to meet on Senator Moi.
Senator Price, before you leave, I just want to let you know that the new majority leader has turned our office into a conference room, if you've been there lately.
I'll have to go check that out.
Oh, gee, the tradition.
Members, we're going to meet on Monday next week. We're losing a day next week because of the budget forecast. So we're going to have, I believe on Thursday next week, we're going to have a joint hearing with finance to take a look at the budget forecast. So we're going to lose that day to hear bills. So we've got a number of bills scheduled for Monday. Don't have plans at this point to meet on Friday. I think Monday's probably a preferable day for members. So this committee's adjourned until Monday.